Hello, everyone. I am Sandy Murillo.
And I am Brett Shishkoff.
And welcome to the Beacon. And welcome to another edition of The Beacon here on this extremely toasty Wednesday evening. I'm here in Chicago. In the last few days, it's been in the 90s, mid-90s, and yeah, that's a sure sign that summer is finally here. I know all winter we were complaining about how cold it was,
and it took a while, we are complaining
about how hot it is.
Yeah, it took a while for the summer to get here, for sure. It seemed like we were having lots of cooler days with lots of rain, and that seems to at least subsided for a few days here. I know, I think I've seen that it's supposed to be off and on scattered thunderstorms throughout the rest of the week. So, we'll see how that goes, if it cools down anything or if it just makes it like Chicago swamp weather.
Like we saw in the last few months, like in April and May, you know, Brad, like some days it was raining, other days it was cold, other days it was warm.
Yeah,
so it's how I, you know, I like to call this the bipolar weather.
It is,
you know,
I think we're transitioning out of the bipolar weather maybe, and we're getting into more of the hot and humid dog days of summer, and so yeah, I think that with the way that the weather tends to be at this time of the year, I'm not a big fan of the heat. I enjoy when it's a little bit cooler, and now having a guide dog, Mr. Poet over here, he likes it actually a little bit cooler as well.
Oh, I'm sure.
Warmer days, he definitely starts huffing and puffing relatively quickly and wants to take multiple breaks, or he's actually taking me on routes of, oh, wait, the cement is hot. I want to go to the more shaded area of the cement, which isn't always the safest place for me to be. So I've had to tell him to kind of, hey, you got to suck it up. I know the pavement's a little bit warm, but you can't be just sitting in the shade because that's building that you're running me into. So,
well, no, and that's something that I've always wondered about. You know, I'm not a guide dog user myself, but that's what I've heard from other friends who are guide dog users. You know, the fact that during the summer, that is one of the biggest issues, like the hot pavement, and which I totally get. And then during the winter is, of course, you know, getting salt on their paws.
Right. Yep.
And so there's...
Yeah, they gave us booties to get put on their, you know, paws and whatnot when it is really, really hot out. But they don't like them. Like, when I put it on him, I haven't put him on since we got back from our training.
Sure.
But it ends up that, like, when I put it on during training, because we have to, whenever you go on escalators, you actually have to put on the back booties, which doesn't affect him as much. But if you put on both the front and the back,
sure,
he would just, like, turn into Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. Oh, man, what did I do to deserve this? So he kind of gets really depressed and starts to kind of slow down his pace and kind of jumps around like a deer a little bit. And so it's just kind of funny because his response to the booties at first is like, it's a punishment. And then they eventually get used to it and is totally fine after a 5 minutes of kind of being a gloomy Gus, I guess you could say.
Sure.
But yeah, it is definitely something that they do give us the booties to try and protect their paws as much as possible, because it is a pretty sensitive area
for
them. And they basically said that if you put your hand on the cement and it's hot to your touch, like you can't keep it there for more than 10 seconds, then you probably want to put the booties onto your Poet to be able to make sure that he's more comfortable than if he's, you know, burning his paws.
Mm-hmm. And now this is your third week back with him in Chicago, right?
Yes. Actually,
second,
let's see. I believe, let's see, I want to say the 15th, so tomorrow will be a month that I've had him, actually.
Wow, a month already?
Been a month already.
Wow.
And that's crazy to think that a month would actually be the time that me and him have been together.
Yeah.
It has flown by super fast because it doesn't feel like it's been a month. It literally just feels like I've only had him for maybe a week or two. Because the training when you're there is so, it's so fast. You're only there for 2 weeks.
Sure.
And all you're doing is go, go, go. You're walking routes. You're doing obedience training at first and learning how to take care of the dog. What type of food does he eat? How often do you feed him, water him, relieve him? All of those things. So you're just learning so much so quickly that you don't realize that the 2 weeks literally is like a blink of an eye.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you get back and you're like, do I remember everything I learned?
Sure.
Because it was so fast. So yeah, we definitely are working on little things here and there throughout the week that he messes up. Maybe he gets to the wrong part of the down curb. So like when you're trying to cross the street, he actually will go sometimes a little too far left of the down curb to just a regular curb. And that's not exactly the crosswalk. So I'll have to try and navigate him to where he needs to be. And so, those are the little small things that we're working on. But for the most part, he's very good at knowing where he's supposed to be. Other than we've had a very windy few days here. And so it ends up like the leaves have been flying around. So he thinks it's time to chase some leaves.
Oh.
So, him being still a puppy 20 months or so, he's still that kid-like exuberance. So there's sometimes where something will fly past his face and he'll get a little distracted and want to go chase after it. And then he's, I just remembered.
I'm
harness.
I'm working.
Mm-hmm. And then he'll get back to doing what he's supposed to. So
sure.
It's been kind of fun these first few weeks back because it is way different than when you're out at the school because they've worked these routes a few times. They've been in areas for the most part that they recognize.
Exactly.
So it ends up now that he's back in he's in a new area. He's with me, who's a completely new person. He only has known me for a few weeks. And so this is all new to him for the most part. And it's new to me as well. And so we're learning together and we're just kind of little by little trusting each other more and more each day.
No, it's like you were telling me earlier, it's like teamwork. It is teamwork.
Yep.
It's not like you get the dog and you instantly connect with each other.
Right.
It takes time. And, I know that sometimes people ask me how do guide dogs work? And I'm like, well, it's definitely not Lassie,
Right. Yeah.
You have to be able to tell the dog where you're going.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember once in a psychology textbook, it was in high school, and there was this little section on guide dogs, and in there it said that the guide dog could actually read the signs, like the lights and stuff to cross the street, like tell the colors, and I was like, no, I knew better.
Right,
and
yeah.
I was like, first of all, dogs are colorblind, they can't see the lights.
Yeah.
And so I just found it, interesting that you would even find that in a textbook. It just comes to show that people still have to learn a lot about.
Right. And when you, some things that maybe is some of our listeners might not understand is you do still have to have good orientation skills. Like to be able to get a guide dog, you can't just, if you're a person going through a loss of your sight, if you do actually are visually impaired, you can get a guide dog. I wish I would have known that when I still had my sight because I had difficulty with stairs and being able to see when they would go down. So I'd miss stairs sometimes, especially because a lot of times there was no contrast difference between say it would be carpet.
Sure.
The carpet would go down the stairs the same color. And so to me, it looked flat.
Mm-hmm.
So there would be times I'd miss stairs that were coming up to me. I knew they were coming soon, but I wouldn't know exactly where they were at. No depth perception because of not having my left eye to fall back on. And so just those type of things of being able to have the stair help. And then also, I didn't have very good peripheral vision down low.
Sure.
So it ends up that that's where the dog would be able to help navigate me around maybe children or maybe if there was chairs or stools or something that was down low in my vision that I was missing and blind spots that I had. that was one thing my trainer, while I was away, she's like, why didn't you get one when you were visually impaired? And I said, I didn't even think about it.
Sure.
I didn't even know I could. Mm-hmm, I thought you had to be blind to get a guide dog. So if any of our listeners are interested and you do have a visual impairment or you do see yourself starting to lose some of your vision, maybe a guide dog would be an answer for you, especially if you have some peripheral vision issues. That could be a good thing to look into. So I know for me, I wish I would have known all this information, you know, 5-6 years ago while I was going through the vision loss, or even most of my life. It's quite nice having a guide dog, but it is a bit of work, and you do need to have some good orientation, knowing where you're going to be going, how to get there, and your timing changes. So you're not going to be able to use that tactile feedback with your cane. You actually have to have a good amount of timing in your head of like, okay, I'm moving faster now. I need to make sure if I'm going to be coming to this building, it's not going to take me 3 minutes to get there. It might take me only 2 minutes to get there. Mm-hmm. So it's like compensating for that increased speed that you're walking with the dog.
Sure.
There's a lot that I didn't realize. Yeah.
No, and you know, I'm sure that a lot of listeners might have questions or would like more information about guide dogs in general. And later on down the road, we'll be sure to speak with, you know, a guide dog school, or so that people can get a better sense of
the process. Yeah, I might even at some point, I was telling you that I'm in contact with the people that that I was in class with. And so maybe I'll have one of them to come on at some point and interview them about how their process is going to see if there's any differences. I've already been seeing emails from them of a lot of us having a lot of the same concerns of us being in new areas and the dogs having to compensate with a completely new place.
Sure.
And so that might be an interesting segment possibly down the line. And I got my guide dog through Guide Dogs for the Blind, which is out in California. Mm-hmm. We kind of briefly talked about him being a San Franciscan last week. And that's out in San Rafael, California, about 30 minutes north of San Francisco. But there's plenty of other guide dog schools out there, and we have a lot of people here at the Lighthouse who have guide dogs as well, who have gotten them from a wide variety of schools.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that might be something we can explore a little bit further down the line.
Definitely. Well, moving on, I'm sure you're aware, Brett, that this past Friday was a very busy Friday here at the Lighthouse.
Yes, we kind of spoke about it a little bit last week, and you went to the gala for the Lighthouse. How did that go?
Oh, yeah, it was our annual Seeing What's Possible gala. Very nice event. It was held at the Four Seasons here in Chicago. That was Friday evening, and it went amazingly well. I mean, these events, they you know, we're fortunate that they always go well.
That's good.
But I think this year, first of all, like we mentioned last week, we did a short trailer on the PBS documentary that'll be airing later on this fall.
Okay.
And we also awarded Larry Broutman, who is part of our board of directors. We gave him the Beacon of Light Award.
Oh, okay.
You know, he's been very involved with the Lighthouse and very supportive. And we also recognized our Dick Schnadek, our board chair, who will be, this is the end of his tenure, and, you know, as part of our board. So we, you know, gave him a recognition. The event, it was emceed, I should say, by Leah Hope from ABC7.
Oh, okay. Very cool.
So, you know, we got to meet her, and it was great. And then we actually broke a record this year. We don't have the exact figures yet, and we'll be sure to share those later on. But during our live auction and fund a need part of the program, our goal was to raise $100,000. And right now it's estimated that we raised around $125,000.
Very good. And there's still more to hopefully come as they finish the calculations.
Exactly. Like. And this is, you know, this is apart from like the silent auction, the tickets, the other donations that we received. So, you know, needless to say, it was a very successful event.
That's good. And you said they do this annually? Is that what you said?
Yeah, we do it usually in May or June.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great way to learn more about the lighthouse, the work that the lighthouse does.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you know, Brett, we have 39 different programs and services for people of all ages,
mm-hmm.
who are blind or visually impaired or veterans.
Yep.
A big thing for us here is also researching like low vision and mm-hmm. better ways to adapt. You know, basically things that'll help people who are blind or visually impaired to live more independent lives.
Right. Yep. That's really cool. I'm glad it went so well, and you guys definitely set the bar high, and hopefully we can continue to blow those out of the water for the years to come.
Mm-hmm. We hope so too. So that, you know, I know that especially in this time, it's such a critical time with the different issues going on with, you know, the budget and just different things. So it's critical for us to continue, like you said, raising the bar. And
yeah, when you don't have the, you know, state or federal funding that you used to have, you have to rely on the donors and people to be able to, you know, pick up the slack. And luckily, we've been able to have that with the people who are part of the lighthouse or have been touched by the lighthouse.
Absolutely.
That really does help to pick up the slack, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to have the reach that we have and be able to help the people that the lighthouse has been able to help for many, many, many years.
Yeah, for 111 years now.
Yes.
You
know, so
we've been around for quite some time. And, you know, this will help us, like I said, continue with our school, with our employment services program, seniors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of the other services and programs that we have, including our research mm-hmm. center. And, you know, speaking of research, I don't know, Brett, have you ever been asked if your senses get stronger because of your vision loss?
Yes, all the time.
Yep, I do too. And we'll talk more about it after this next segment. But this next segment, I actually interviewed Dr. Corinna Bauer from the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary, and she did some very interesting research on how the brain actually adapts in the case of people who are young, who lost their sight young or were born without sight.
Mm-hmm.
The brain almost rewires to compensate for your lack of sight. So let's listen to the report. Hello, everyone, and once again, I welcome you to another edition of our segment, Sandy's View. I am Sandy Murillo, and today I'm talking about a very interesting topic that for many years has actually intrigued many people. I know that a lot of a common question, rather, that people who are blind or visually impaired, myself included, that we get often is that, are our senses, do they improve? Do they kick in? In other words, when we lose a sense, do our other senses get stronger? And recent research from the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary found very interesting discoveries about this fascinating topic. And joining us today is Dr. Corinna Bauer. And Dr. Bauer, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Sandy.
So tell us a little bit about your research. I understand that you led this research to understand more about the brain and how the senses are affected.
Yeah, that's right. So you mentioned that people were curious as to whether or not the other non-visual senses are enhanced.
Mm-hmm.
And in the literature, there's been many studies that say that this is, in fact, the case in individuals, especially those who lost their sight early in age.
Mm-hmm.
So what we wanted to do was to see how the structural and functional connections in the brain of individuals who lost their sight at an early age compare to those who are normally sighted. So we had about 12 individuals who were early ocular blind
mm-hmm.
Compared to 16 controls. And we used a few techniques. One of them is called diffusion MRI, and it looks at essentially the connections, so like the highways in your brain. And then we have a technique called functional imaging, and what this does is look at how well signals within different areas of your brain correlate with one another on a time, like a temporal time scale, with the thought that areas that fire in a similar time frame will be then functionally connected.
Hmm.
Yeah. So what we found was that there are actually a number of areas that show increases or decreases in both structural and functional connections in the individuals who lost their sight early. And a lot of these changes imply that other sensory areas become strengthened and that the connections to those areas become strengthened.
So when you talk about people that were born blind or lost their sight early on, how early on are we talking about?
Yeah, that's a great question. So our participants all had onset either at birth or prior documented visual loss prior to the age of 3.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I see. So then you mentioned about, in one of the articles I read, you mentioned about the connections, you know, being stronger connections, so that people better understand, are we talking about stronger sensory connections, like, you know, for hearing, for example, or touch,
right?
Or can you explain that?
In this, that's a great question. In this study, we didn't actually test hearing function or tactile function themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's what we found was connections that were strengthened to the areas of the brain that we know process that information.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the method that we use, this is actually the number of connections was that we were able to reconstruct mathematically from the diffusion data was stronger. So there were more of them that could be reconstructed.
Now, was this for... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Nope, that's...
Yeah, so is this just for like the other four senses, you know, touch, smell, hearing, taste? Did you notice these connections increase?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. We didn't do taste, obviously. But definitely.
Exactly.
Yeah, but auditory and somatosensory, so touch and motor areas showed increased connections.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know, what do you think this research will essentially, how do you think it will help, you know, maybe better understand blindness or, you know, get a better idea of how people are affected by blindness? How do you think it'll help?
Sure. I think that what it really does is it brings a better understanding, I think, to some of the changes that do occur and that can occur in the brain to sort of compensate for the loss of visual input. One of them being that these other senses could be heightened. And I think what it also really does is sort of provide a research framework moving forward that can be applied to other visual disorders. For example, as technology increases more and more, some of the leading causes of blindness are now becoming brain-based rather than eye-based. And so there's many children nowadays who have what's called cortical or cerebral visual impairment, but not much is known about it. So we're hoping to apply the same framework by using multiple different types of imaging to look at structural, functional, and sort of geometric changes in the brain to see how those relate to the visual deficits that these children have.
So do you plan to also do research like on people that lost their sight later on in life, or is it mostly geared to people who lost it early on or were born blind? In other words, do you have any plans for future research on this?
At the moment, we don't have any scans planned and studies planned for comparing early compared to late blind.
Sure.
But it's something that in the future we're always open to and we may pursue in the future.
Great, great. So now you mentioned earlier about there being literature, you know, about this common common idea about the enhanced senses of people who are blind. Had previous studies been done on this? I know that in 2009, there was something done similar done at UCLA. Were there any previous studies done regarding this subject?
Yeah, that's a good question. There actually have been a number of previous studies. Hmm. And our study was unique in the combination of methods used. And mm-hmm. also, many of the previous studies typically only report decreases in structural and functional connectivity, mm-hmm. and a lot of them look mostly at the occipital, so the traditionally what's known as the visual cortex.
Sure.
And many decreases are observed there, as you might expect.
Mm-hmm.
So we're one of the first to show increases in other parts of the brain.
Sure. Sure, no, and like we mentioned earlier, this will lead to a better understanding about how vision loss affects both the person, the brain, and the person.
Yeah.
You mentioned about, you know, the research aspect. And you know, here at the Lighthouse, we focus, you know, one of our main focuses providing rehabilitation services to people who are blind, you know, who are either born blind. We have programs for children, and we have programs also for adults who became blind later on in life. How do you think that this research will, you know, maybe help us help, you know, not just the Lighthouse, but everyone better understand and develop rehabilitation for these individuals?
Yeah, I think what we know is that the brain is plastic. It is mm-hmm. capable of changing and adapting. And I think that, you know, the more we understand about that process, the more we can sort of cater the education and the rehabilitation strategies to really sort of take advantage of that ability that the brain has. So I think that this study can kind of reinforce that and provide evidence that, yes, if you further train the auditory senses or the tactile and motor senses, that perhaps the brain can adapt for increased abilities in these areas.
Definitely. And that's something that we are always, you know, looking for, to find better ways of improving not just the rehabilitation, but the quality of life for people with vision loss.
Yeah.
Is there something else you'd like to add or share with our listeners?
I just wanted to thank you again for the opportunity. This has been really wonderful, and it's always good to hear the feedback from the community. So
great. Well, thank you. And again, this was Dr. Karina Bauer from Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary, who was explaining to us a little bit about recent research that proves that, or that at least begins to show, that the senses of people who are blind might become enhanced after vision loss, as people have previously suggested or alluded to. For more information about this or to read our Sandy's View blog, go to www.chicagolighthouse.org. Again, on our Sandy's View blog, you will find a commentary on this topic as well as many other topics related to vision loss. Dr. Bauer, thank you so much for your time, and good luck on your future research.
Thank you.
All right. Well, there you have it, everyone. And it's very interesting research, isn't it, Brett?
Yeah, I definitely think there is a lot to what she was talking about, but I also think that going through the vision loss that I had, I definitely think that you more pay attention to the other senses than them being, I guess, heightened, because they're always there. I think it ends up just your brain is an amazing thing, and it's able to really just understand that you're missing a certain part of you, and it has to be able to compensate for that somehow. And so I definitely think that, you know, be it better hearing, better sense of smell, whatever it ends up being, or even if you're deaf, maybe your vision's really, really, you know, better than what it would be. It's just an amazing thing to think about the human brain and how well it can compensate for a loss like a loss of a sense.
No, and that's exactly what she was also mentioning. And, you know, this, I've always told people that it's not that we, you know, that our senses are physiologically stronger. It's that we pay more attention to them, to our hearing, to our touch. And it's, you know, that's exactly what she also pointed it out, that, you know, the senses are not physically stronger, but it's more of the brain.
Yeah.
You know, that, like you said, it's an amazing organ that can adapt to different circumstances. I know that even for me, I lost my sight very young. But, you know, it's all my life I've had to learn to pay more attention, like you said, focus more on the different sounds, sense of touch. I know that sometimes I'll pick up on, you know, like if there's a bus coming or if there's, we're walking past somewhere and I hear water fountain, and I'll point to, I'll point this out to whoever I'm with, and they'll be like, "How did you know? I couldn't even hear it." And I'm like, "Well, I pay more attention. Just, you know, like you might see it with your eyes. I myself have to focus more on my hearing. It just comes natural to me to pay more attention,
right,
to sounds, to touch, even to smells, you know, because some people might not be aware, but even simple things like that. You mentioned earlier orientation and mobility with guide dogs. But even, you know, even your senses serve as great cues to get oriented to your surroundings. You know, like if you get to near a bakery, you know, you might tell that, be able to tell by the smell that you're near your job or near your school, or, you know, feeling like the grass underneath your feet, underneath your feet, you know, you'll know where you are. And
also, I one of the things that I was taught really, like, I want to say it was one of the first lessons I had after losing my sight for orientation and mobility was, like, feeling where the sun was at.
Exactly.
So, like, you know, when you lose your sight and you're trying to walk in a straight line, it's extremely difficult. So it ends up that you try and use whatever you can to help you walk in the straight line. And so when I would realize that the sun was starting to move across my face from one direction to another, then I knew I was starting to turn. And so, you know, you start to learn these little nuances here and there. And, like, I like to call it our spidey sense that we have of that, like, presence of something changes, the pressure changes, and you're able to tell, okay, there's no longer a wall there, or there's no longer a person there. And so you pick up on that a lot more. You're paying attention to that so much to know when to turn, or when you, the building line is no longer there. So you're definitely using, like, your sense of touch when it comes to, like, the sun side of things, and then you're also using hearing that most people don't pay attention to, unless you actually, like, close your eyes, because I remember I would close my eyes and someone would come up to me and I could feel their presence behind me to the, you know, to my right or left. And so you have that, like, you definitely have that sense your entire life, but it's not until you actually, like, pay attention to it that it's more predominant, that you pay attention to it on a more regular basis.
Exactly.
That was one thing when I was doing sound design for film and TV before I lost my sight, was I was always, being visually impaired, I would always be audible first and then visual. So I would always kind of develop soundscapes based off of, okay, when I'm in this movie scene, can I actually feel like I'm in that scene? You know, if we're in a, walking through a mall, or if you're walking through a forest, does it feel like I'm actually walking in the forest with these characters? And so that's kind of the way I would develop my sound design, is literally, can I close my eyes and know where I'm supposed to be at? Or does it sound like a completely different space?
Right. Yeah, no, because there, you know, there are definitely those instances on TV or movies, or, you know, that you'll hear, especially when you're blind, you'll hear one thing, but it's totally unrelated to the visuals.
Right.
What's going on.
Yeah, sometimes you'll hear it with voices specifically. Like, you'll it'll almost sound like someone's talking in, like, a cavern, and it's supposed to be, you know, just an office. And you're like, well, that's kind of weird reverb that they're using. Or maybe they recorded it in a place that isn't like the studio we're in, which is really treated to kind of cut down on, you know, sounds bouncing all over the place.
For those of you that haven't been to Chris Radio or haven't volunteered, the booths here are very soundproof. You know, you can sense it. You can tell when you're in here, you know, like we are right now sitting with the door closed and...
The pressure changes.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
People in the other studio that I sit in most of the time, it's a bit smaller than this one. Mm-hmm. And people feel like they get claustrophobic when they walk in because they can feel the pressure change and it like messes with them quite a bit.
Yeah.
So even that, people who are sighted, they can have that. They just get a little taste of what our life is on a regular basis of just walking through, you know, one doorway of being in our open area to more of a treated studio space.
Yeah.
You get to feel just that pressure change that we actually pay attention to on a regular basis.
Exactly. They, ironically enough, they get a taste, if you will.
Yep. Exactly.
About, you know, using your other senses and paying more attention to the other senses.
And speaking of tastes, I actually have my segment that I did, speaking on, like nutrition and how your food can affect your mood. So I actually did an interview with Dr. Gita Maker Clark. She's over at North Shore, and I'll let you guys listen to it, and then we'll have a little bit of a discussion afterwards. Me and Sandy will kind of talk about it a little bit further. So
here's that interview.
Hello there, everybody. This is Brett Shishkoff. I am actually here today with Dr. Gita Maker Clark, and she is going to talk about food as medicine and how food can affect our mood. You care to give a little brief introduction there, Dr. Maker Clark?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming in.
My name is Gita Maker Clark. Like you said, I am a family physician. I have specialty training in something called integrative medicine. Integrative medicine is a field that focuses on taking the entire patient's lifestyle, community, mind, body, spirit, and health needs into the picture and creating an individual plan. Within integrative medicine, I have a great focus on using food as medicine, and my practice really revolves around using food as medicine, meaning we talk about nutrition as not just a primary prevention strategy for chronic disease, but also as a way of treating many chronic diseases. Along those lines, I teach a class at the medical school at University of Chicago called Culinary Medicine, where we're training medical students to become better nutritional counselors, as well as how to cook with a chef.
Oh, very nice. So then when you are having patients coming in, what seems to be some of the major complaints that you are able to help people with? Is it like inflammation, or tends to be the most common reasons that people come to see you?
Yeah, a lot of my patients are coming to see me because they've already tried many pharmaceuticals and other approaches to combating their chronic diseases and haven't gotten the kind of results that they want, and so they're looking for something different. They're looking for something that maybe they overlooked, or maybe something that will be easier for them to use than another medicine that they have already tried or are suffering from side effects of. So that's sort of the typical, you know, patient that I see, regardless of what their disease process is.
Mm-hmm. So then, when it comes down to it, you have the mentality of we should have some type of baseline with the diet getting a little bit better before you start adding any type of medications or adding anything on top of that. Start with the diet, and then you can work your way into possibly other things. You're more based in more naturalistic, I guess you could say. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. I'm interested in us making sure that the foundation is in place for the body to do the work that it already knows how to do. because our bodies have, you know, tremendously sophisticated systems to keep us healthy. Our immune systems work really well when they're being fed what they're supposed to be fed. And so my interest is making sure that that foundation is in place for the body to do its work.
Very good. So then some suggestions on how we could be able to kind of get our body right from the food standpoint. What foods do you normally recommend people to kind of start off with to get themselves having a good foundation?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's a lot of research available now over many decades that are pointing to the concept that a plant-based diet is really one of the healthiest ways that we can eat. And you see some of the healthiest societies and civilizations in the world eat in this way. A plant-based diet basically means that there's little to no animal protein in the diet. And while this doesn't need to be followed down to the T, I usually try to get my patients to at least start moving in that direction. And the easiest way to do that is to just increase the amount of vegetables that you eat.
Okay, so what happens with someone who is relatively pickier? I'm sure you have a few of those people who will come in and they only maybe have a few specific vegetables that they maybe like. Do you kind of just base a plan around those main vegetables that they do enjoy, or do you kind of, how do you work around that for those people who are a little bit pickier of eaters, let's say?
Yeah, that's a great question. And yes, the answer is I do absolutely work with where we're at, where they're starting from. So if they, you know, tell me, hey, I like these four vegetables. I like tomatoes. I like broccoli. I like carrots, and I like corn. We just work from there. Well, how many of those vegetables are you eating in a day?
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not every day, let's start making that a daily practice for you to be eating those four vegetables that you really enjoy every day. And then we can slowly start to build. What that means for me is working with them on saying, okay, if we can create, you can tell me a dish that you like that has corn and tomatoes in it. Let's see if we can add one more vegetable into that, or even some herbs into it, some fresh herbs like basil or, you know, parsley.
Mm-hmm.
And patients are sometimes surprised, you know, to realize how much they actually do like when we sit and kind of go through a food intake. So even the pickiest patient, you know, we can work with, because it can mean increasing the volume of what they do enjoy. And then usually they're more open to some variety as they start to feel better. I'm not very picky about what those vegetables are that somebody eats, as long as there's lots of different colors.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of variety over time, because the colors of a vegetable correspond to different antioxidants. And antioxidants help fight cellular damage in the body. So the more colorful the vegetables are, the better off you're going to be.
Okay. So then let's move on to someone who has a little bit of a sweet tooth and they have trouble with eating a majority of vegetables. What are some of the recommendations for someone who does have a little bit of a sweet tooth?
You know, there's a lot of ways to satisfy a sweet tooth over time that don't involve using refined sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I think that the most important thing is to be aware of the fact that you have cravings for sweets and kind of think about what that might be coming from. For many people, that sweet tooth, so to speak, or that sweet craving is actually coming from the fact that they aren't eating enough vegetables, proteins, whole grains. And if we start adding those things in, the cravings towards sugar start to slowly dissipate.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a list of, you know, sweet vegetables that, like sweet potatoes, for instance, with recipes for baked sweet potato fries,
mm-hmm.
that can sometimes help satisfy those kinds of cravings. But the most important thing is really to try to avoid refined sugar and even head towards something like fruit, which, while it has sugar in it, is also combined with fiber and is absorbed very differently in the body and certainly comes along with a lot of nutrients as well.
Okay, very nice. So then let's move on to that person who they need to have some type of meat in their diet. What are some healthier meats that you normally recommend to your patients?
I think for the patient who, you know, isn't ready to eliminate meat from their diet or just really likes to, and enjoys consuming meat, I would just be very particular that it needs to be the highest quality meat that a patient can afford. My biggest concern around meat in our country right now is that it is very highly processed, number one, so I would avoid deli meat as much as possible. But then also the animals in our industrialized food system are being given hormones, antibiotics. They're kept in very crowded conditions where they're at great risk for an infection, and they're also very stressed animals. So their stress hormone levels are very high. So when you eat them, these meats, you're not just consuming a lot of saturated fat, but also antibiotics, hormones, and stress hormones. And ultimately, that's really terrible for human health. So I would ask patients to at least go for grass-fed organic meat whenever possible. And if not possible, to try to avoid meat altogether.
What about, fish, if someone would prefer doing some fish or grilled chicken, boiled chicken, is that something that you normally recommend, or you just kind of avoid it as much as possible and stick with the vegetables?
Well, like I said, if you're going to eat meat, I'm very concerned that it's just the highest quality meat that you can eat.
Okay.
So chicken is something you enjoy. If it's organic, that is ideal.
Okay.
And if it's not, I would minimize how much you eat of it per week, like less than 2 servings per week.
Okay.
Chicken should always be consumed with the skin off.
Okay.
As far as your question around fish, I think fish is actually a great substitute for meat if a patient is looking for an animal protein, because fish has omega-3 fatty acids. And omega-3 fatty acids are actually very powerful anti-inflammatories. So fish like salmon, for instance, and tilapia, sardines even, have very high levels of omega-3, and this actually can be very good for one's health. I would encourage people to buy their fish wild-caught and not farmed.
Okay.
And also try to eat smaller fish that don't concentrate mercury.
Okay, very nice. So then one of the things that I read on another article was talking about mood and how what you eat can affect your mood. Can you kind of elaborate a little bit on specific foods that might bring your mood, maybe cause you some sadness, or you just have a drop in energy? What are some of those foods? And then we can move into some energy boosting, making you feel better type foods.
Right. I think that if you're having difficulty maintaining a stable mood or have issues with depression in general, it's really important to factor in how much food might be playing a part of it. One thing that's obviously very common in people's daily routines is coffee. And caffeine can make one feel, you know, energized and maybe improve their mood very temporarily. But actually, the ups and downs of sugar and mood swings that caffeine can cause are ultimately not good for, you know, feeling blue and feeling down.
Mm-hmm.
I'd really try to make sure patients are keeping an eye on how much caffeine they're taking in a day. So they might be having coffee and then tea and then a soda or hot chocolate, and all of these things contain caffeine in them.
Okay.
So trying to limit that's important. It's also important, I think, to not eat very big meals at night. A large meal at night can keep you awake while your digestion is working. You know, your digestive system is working really hard on that. A better idea would be to have a larger breakfast and then decrease the amount of food they're eating throughout the day to have the smallest meal of the day at night.
Okay.
And that will allow for a better sleep, which is better for mood. Certainly alcohol does not do anyone any favors when it comes to mood, and that's an important thing to start keeping track of, and preferably avoid nighttime alcohol, which can affect morning a morning sense of refreshment.
Okay.
And then there's always sugar. You know, I think it's very important to talk about sugar when it comes to mood, because the ups and downs that refined sugar can cause are very severe. So to keep blood sugar stable throughout the day, one hopes to eat things that are considered more of a low glycemic index, that are harder to digest, and not refined grains and refined sugars.
Okay, and now we can kind of move on to the opposite of that, the ones that kind of boost our energy and kind of keep us feeling good throughout the day.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think we know that the B vitamin folate is extremely important in the synthesis of the neurotransmitters that keep us feeling good. And that those B vitamins, the folate in particular, are found in dark green, leafy green vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
They're also found in Brussels sprouts and beans and in whole grains. So folate is something that I focus on my patients who are struggling with depression, and making sure they're getting plenty of folate on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. One way of doing that, too, is getting it into a smoothie in the morning by using greens in a smoothie. And then the second really important piece, important nutrient, is the omega-3 fatty acids that I spoke about when we were talking about fish. So omega-3s have been shown to improve depression in multiple studies. And these can be achieved through walnuts, flax seeds, hemp seeds, avocado, omega-3 enriched eggs, as well as in fish. And I will often supplement patients with fish oil supplements, krill oil or krill oil supplements,
mm-hmm.
to get high levels of omega-3 into their diet.
Very nice. So I'm going to close it with, if anyone wants to get more information, where could they go to be able to get some more of information from you, of maybe some suggestions on some foods that they should be keeping an eye out for?
Yeah. Well, I do have a website. It's drgeetamakerclark.com. That does have some information about the anti-inflammatory diet. And I would also, you know, look to there's some great internet resources around plant-based diet. And so I would look to some of those as well to get some guidelines. Dr. Andrew Weil's website, drweil.com, is another great source.
Okay. And then that website is drgeetamakerclark.com. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Maker Clark, for coming on. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I actually learned a lot, so I'm going to be implementing these into my diet myself. So thank you very much for coming on the show and giving me some pointers to hopefully help me in a few different things with my diet.
Thanks for having me.
This is Brett Shishkoff, and I want to thank everyone for listening in. I will be back again very soon with another great segment and hopefully a great interview. I hope all of you have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you soon.
Chris Radio needs to know. We want your comments and feedback. We're making changes to what we program on Chris, and we need your help. What's good? What's bad? What would you like to hear on Chris Radio? Just call 712-832-2724. That's 712-832-2724. Press 0 at any time to send us your comments. And thanks for listening to Chris Radio.
Discover Choice Magazine Listening, the free audio magazine for blind people. Call 1-888-7-CHOICE.
If you are a veteran looking for a job, or if you know an unemployed veteran, Paralyzed Veterans of America's Employment Office, Operation PAVE at the Hines VA in Chicago can help. Our services are free. To learn more, visit OperationPAVE.org, a public service of Paralyzed Veterans of America.
Wow, very interesting. I know that in the past, you know, we've had Lainey talk to us about nutrition and healthy recipes, and I think that it's something that we as Americans have to, you know, become more aware of.
Right.
You know, the different foods that can help us be more healthy and, you know, essentially live better lives.
Yeah. Her main thing was we eat a lot of processed foods.
Mm-hmm.
And she was talking about, you know, the vegetable side of things and fruits and nuts and being parts like your main source of your energy and being able to keep you, you know, throughout your day, not feeling sluggish. Mm-hmm. And like she said, affect, you know, your mood. It can affect your energy level. It also can make you feel, you know, you got pains in different parts of your body. And if you can get your diet right, you'd be surprised on how well that helps with just almost every issue that we have medically. It can really help dramatically decrease the severity of the pains that you're feeling in your body. Maybe you have some digestive issues, and just a minor change of your diet can actually help to fix those, because you're literally certain foods your body's allergic to, and we still eat them. And that's, you know, that's why people are gluten intolerant, lactose intolerant, and we sometimes don't realize that those foods are actually causing us to kind of bloat or get overweight or have headaches. And so there's so many important aspects of eating right that we as Americans unfortunately don't pay attention to it enough.
Well, it's pretty amazing, you know, because I know that I've had this conversation with other people about how, you know, our grandparents or even our great grandparents, you know, they, you know, were very healthy and lived, you know, very, like I said, very healthy lives. And nowadays, like you've mentioned earlier, we have like different, you know, symptoms. We might feel bloated. We mm-hmm. might have different aches and pains.
Right.
And it's just fascinating to think that it's a great deal of that is due to, you know, like you said, the different processed foods and different meats that we process, meats that we eat mm-hmm. here as Americans. We eat, you know, a lot of this stuff on a daily basis. And it's things, like you said, that we probably know we shouldn't be eating, mm-hmm. but at the same time we do, you know.
Yep.
And there's a lot of factors to that, I think. You know, sometimes people might be just in a hurry and they just grab whatever's nearby, you know, stop at a restaurant, at a fast food restaurant, or, you know, just grab whatever's closest.
Yep, there's a McDonald's on almost every corner, mm-hmm. you know, it's what's most convenient. And
yes.
I know for me, it's always seems like it's time is why I don't eat as healthy as I probably should.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you make yourself a quick sandwich.
Yes.
You put, you know, you grab a little bag of chips. Like, mm-hmm. they're very quick. They're very easy. And maybe little things that you can do. And I think we, you know, don't think about it. But maybe that sandwich that we eat, instead of it being, you know, a salami and cheese sandwich, maybe just switching it over to like a peanut butter sandwich,
mm-hmm.
just by itself. There's a little bit of that protein from the peanut butter, and there's some good fats in there that is actually good for your body. And just switching from white bread to wheat bread or even rye bread. Like, the little things you can do to still have your sandwiches, or just changing little things here and there are healthier for you and not as bad for your body.
Mm-hmm.
So I know I actually go see a dietitian, and the main thing she actually tells me is you actually do need protein, and lots of water.
Sure.
And she said, and then you want to sprinkle in as much of vegetables as you can to compensate for filling you up a little bit more. The mm-hmm. fibers that you're going to get is from your, mostly your vegetables and your nuts and your fruits and stuff like that. So,
and that's something that we've covered in our Sandy's View blog, and I invite everyone to check it out. You can find it on our website, www.chicagolighthouse.org, and feel free to comment or to leave any suggestions. And again, everyone, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure, like always. And if you have any suggestions or comments, feel free to contact myself. Once again, my email is Sandy, S-A-N-D-Y, .MURILLO @ chicagolighthouse.org. Or you can call me at 312-447-3439. All right. right. Well, that about does it for us, Brett. Everyone stay cool and have a great evening. Oh, and also feel free to check out our podcasts on the Chicago Lighthouse website. You can go to chicagolighthouse.org/radio. And there you can either listen live to Chris Radio or you can listen to this and other podcasts. Thank you to Dr. Janet Slick, our president and CEO, and Brian Hawkins, assistant director here at Chris Radio. And thanks to everyone for listening. Good night, everyone.